Support for this episode comes from Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company, who have proudly provided California attorneys with specialized professional liability coverage for over 45 years. And did you know? Lawyers Mutual offers competitive specialty rates for their members who act as a neutral, either on a full-time or part-time basis. So, as part of their arbitration mediation specialty program, all members receive an individualized premium based on the areas of practice their firm handles. This allows Lawyers Mutual to adjust rates annually, and as you build your mediation practice, your premium will reflect the portion of your time spent working as a neutral. To learn more about how this great program can benefit your firm, visit lawyersmutual.com today.
Welcome to the audio edition of BHBA's Mediation Training. In this episode, your host, Angela Reddick Wright of Signature Resolution, will guide you through navigating differences and avoiding bias. Let's dive in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Beverly Hills Bar Association's Mediation Certification Program, the course within that program on bias and implicit bias and how we might manage that within the mediation world. My specific title today is Navigating Differences and Avoiding Bias, a Guide for Mediators. My name is Angela Reddock Wright, and I am a mediator with Signature Resolution, and I'm so privileged and excited to be here. And thank you to the Beverly Hills Bar Association for inviting me to be a part of and to be one of the instructors in your inaugural mediation certification program. I think it's wonderful that the Beverly Hills Bar Association has started its own certification program, and I'm grateful to be a part of it, which gives an overview of my background and experience. And again, I just hopefully you'll see from the work that I've done in practicing for 28 years and now full-time as a mediator for the last 4 years that my insights and experience that I will bring to the table today hopefully is invaluable to you and helps you as you navigate and begin your path as mediators or continue your path as mediators or think about, you know, whether you actually want to enter the mediation field. First, let me begin by giving you an overview of what to expect in today's session. And I would just like to begin again by saying what an exciting journey for those of you who are embarking on your path to becoming mediators or considering it. And even if you're not thinking about becoming a mediator, I'm hopeful that today that the insights and skills that you gain, not just from today's session, but overall in the set of sessions that are part of the certification program, that you will gain skills and insights that not only help you if you're considering a path as a mediator or have already embarked on that path, but that it assists you with wherever you are in your law practice. I know as attorneys, we are hired as advocates and with the expectation that we will zealously represent the interests of our clients. And although it seems counterintuitive and it seems to go against our training as attorneys and against the zealous mindset, what I find now as a full-time mediator, that it's really helpful that even when we are advocates, that we get some training and some insights around the theories and what goes into making a mediation successful. Because even as advocates, it helps us to understand what the process is about and how best to represent our clients in a mediation setting. And it also helps to reframe our thinking as advocates. I'm a former advocate and, you know, represented clients for many, many years in employment matters on both sides of the aisle. But there's a natural instinct when we approach mediation as advocates to kind of keep our litigation hat on or to keep our advocate hat on and to forget that mediation and the process of mediation is that one opportunity or continued opportunity for us to focus on what resolution looks like as opposed to continuing forward with an aggressive litigation or transactional strategy. So I invite you in this 1 hour that we have together, and as you're going through the certification training, to kind of take off your zealous advocate hat, put yourself in the body of a mediator or in the room of an actual mediation process and think about how even as an advocate, you can embrace the concepts of dispute resolution and conflict resolution and use that, whether you're mediating or not, or serving as a mediator or not, to help better serve your clients. And so our goal today in this session is to focus specifically on bias in mediation, how bias arises in mediation, and how we, you know, as mediators, as advocates representing clients, how we can better identify our own biases, manage those in the process, and in managing it, use it to achieve better outcomes in the mediation process. So why is this topic of bias management in mediation important? Specifically in the context of mediation, I'm sure that many who are participating in today and in this certification training have probably sat through, you know, dozens, if not more, classes on bias, implicit bias, microaggressions. In fact, thank you to the Beverly Hills Bar Association. My colleague, former Judge Helene Dondadina, and I, a few months ago in 2024, had the opportunity to present a session on microaggressions in the practice of law. So I'm sure many of you have sat through many trainings like that, and hopefully they've been helpful and helped to advance your thinking around these issues. But today we're going to focus specifically on bias in the context of mediation. And it's important because bias, believe it or not, specifically in a mediation, it can affect our judgment. It can affect our decision making, how we advise our clients on achieving resolution. And it could lead to unfair outcomes, as well as dissatisfaction with the process, the attorneys, the litigants, and the neutral. And one of the worst feelings as a mediator who I really take my cases to heart and really, you know, work hard to give them my all and to own the cases in a way as, you know, so that the parties know that I'm not just hired as your hired gun, so to speak, your paid mediator to get your cases settled, but I take on each case in a way that, you know, hopefully suggests to the parties that this case is important to me, the outcome is important to me. And that, you know, is a great undertaking because when parties or litigants or attorneys are dissatisfied with the process, we as neutrals, believe it or not, really take it to heart. And so one of the things that I seek to achieve in my mediations is not just great outcomes with respect to settlement or helping parties to move their process along, even if it doesn't yield in settlement. But I think on the words of someone that I have admired over the years, and that's famed author and poet Maya Angelou, may she rest in peace. She once said that I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. So understanding bias and the impact on how it makes people feel throughout the process, does it, you know, do we make people feel respected in the process? That goes to the heart of not just settlement and those kind of, you know, positive outcomes from a member's perspective, but it goes to the heart of how people feel about the process overall. And so if attorney, even when cases settle and attorneys or their clients walk away distrusting the process or feeling dissatisfied with the process or feeling disrespected throughout the process, that I would submit to you is not a successful mediation, because the goal also is not just to have a positive settlement members outcome, but the goal is to create a process and to help facilitate a process where everyone feels heard, everyone feels respected, and everyone feels that it was a fair process. So understanding bias is critical to not only the members outcome, but it's also critical to achieving success in terms of satisfaction and trust in the overall mediation process. And we know we live in a climate right now where there's a lot of distrust in, you know, mediation and in mediators even. And so I think we all have to join together, start to embrace some principles that will allow us to create a greater and a better process for our clients, who are the attorneys and the clients that they represent. So it's a critically important topic, bias in mediation. So let's understand bias in mediation, you know, specifically. I call this a focus on the basics, right? What is the definition of bias? So first, before I provide you that definition, first want to say we all have biases. You know, some see the bias word or the B word as negative. And in, you know, many instances, it does have negative connotations. But, you know, the reality is that we all have bias. And why is that? You know, some of us in our trainings, we've probably seen a picture of kind of a person's head. It's a cartoon picture. Or illustrated picture of a person's head and their brain. And it shows that in our brains, that our brains move, the waves in our brains move at many, many milliseconds per minute, right? And I'm not a scientist or a psychologist, so or a doctor, so I hesitate to go into too much detail here. But the general principle that I think many of us have learned, or all of us have learned, is that our brain is constantly moving and processing information. And it processes, you know, what we think, how we think, what we perceive to be good or bad. And it helps us to think through, looking through things through a lens, and processes for us what we should think and how we should think about it. And, you know, how does this happen? Again, I'm not a brain expert or a psychologist, but it happens from when we are in the womb, our mother's womb. Perhaps it's in the things that our parents say to us while we're in the womb, or the things we overhear while we're in our mother's wombs. But for sure, after we're born, our biases and how we think about the world and see the world is shaped, you know, from the environment that we are in, from our family environments to our cultural and religious environments and other societal influence. And from the time that we are infants coming out the womb all the way up until this point in our lives, our brains are constantly receiving information, processing that information, and helping us to decide, in broad terms, this is good. You should think, when you see this, when you touch this, when you feel this, when you see this kind of person, you should automatically see that person or that thing as good. But this thing over here, this is bad. Don't touch it. When you see a person that looks this way, thinks this way, presents in a certain way, think of them as bad. And it's our way, because so much is going on in our brain, it's our brain's way of helping us in a positive way to simplify things and to be able to see things and quickly process things. But in a bad way, it's simplifies our thinking so much in some instances that it causes us to have biases against others and in certain situations that aren't necessarily based on merit or based on any proven, you know, statistics or information about a certain group or a certain individual based on how they present. So we all have biases because our brains, for the most part, and I know, you know, there are different, you know, medical issues and diagnoses and so forth, but, you know, our brains generally process things in a way to help try to simplify how we think about things and how we process things. So that naturally leads to bias, okay? So the first thing, if you don't walk away with anything else today, I want you to understand that we all have the big B, we all have biases, some good, some not so good, and it's the process of identifying those and owning those that are not so good, those biases, that we start to grow and to evolve as individuals, as professionals, as mediators, as attorneys, and all the other hats that we wear. So what is bias? Webster Dictionary simply defines it as an inclination of a temperament or an outlook. Like, it means that we are inclined, based on how we've been socially engineered, to see things in a certain way and to process things in a certain way. And it sometimes leads to personal and unreasoned judgment, which can lead to bias, prejudice, and all the things associated with those not so great words. There are two types of bias generally. There is conscious or explicit bias, and conscious, and there's also unconscious or also known as implicit bias. Conscious or explicit bias is based on the beliefs and attitudes that we have about a person or a group. You know, it's, we're very conscious about it. We know we feel this way about a certain group. Nobody can tell us anything otherwise. And primarily, not because those persons or those groups may be good or bad, but because of how we've been engineered to think about a certain group, we automatically, consciously, and explicitly think of them in a certain way. So for example, depending on our political affiliations, and I know, you know, talking about politics in this climate is not necessarily a safe bet, but, you know, just for purposes of example, if you've been raised as a Democrat, your parents were Democrats and their parents, and, you know, you're very active in the political discussions and, you know, wired toward what might be considered a more liberal or progressive way of thinking, then you're thinking, you know, Democrats are good and Republicans are bad and independents are crazies, right? These are kind of the general assumptions that one might put on a group. Are all Republicans are good and all Democrats are bad, and independents are crazy because they haven't picked one side or the other. Of course, we have good and bad apples on both and all sides of the aisle in the equation. So none of those general statements that we may make, whether it be about political affiliation, race, gender, or any other category, none of those general assumptions that we make tend to be true, because we have good people, good apples, bad apples, on all sides of the equation, no matter what we're talking about. But because we may have been raised in a certain way and raised to only see the world through a certain lens, that could lead to a very conscious and explicit bias that we have about certain individuals and certain groups of people. Now, what is unconscious bias or implicit bias? It is an unconscious attitude or stereotype that we may have, that may not knowingly have, that shapes our understanding, our actions, and our decisions as it relates to certain people, individuals, groups, or situations. And our unconscious biases develop over time based on what we've been wired to think, based again on how we've been socially engineered. Now, for example, if you are the hiring manager or participating in a hiring process within your law firm or organization, you may unconsciously favor individuals who went to your same undergrad or who went to your same law school, right? Again, not bad, but because they are associated with you and share an interest or a background, that you're going to look at that application and you're like, you know, my same alma mater. I know even in my mediations, and I look at the backgrounds of the attorneys, and I see we worked at the same law firm at some point, or, well, no, that's not a good example, but I see if we attended the same school or participate in some of the same organizations, it's not making me favor them more, but I recognize something that we have in common. And so in the mediation, I may bring up, I see we went to the same law school. What was your experience like? And I use it as a way to build connection that and are their client in the mediation. So we have implicit biases that go with us, you know, even when we're not thinking about it or thinking that we're being biased. Another example, in the hiring process, we may be socially engineered to think that individuals by their name. So for example, if they have more of a traditional American Pie type of name or sounding name, such as Ashley, Mary, or John, or Steve, then, you know, we may naturally just think, oh, that person is a, you know, obviously a great qualified, and you might, you know, push their resume to the top of the pile compared to someone who may have more of a culturally, you know, specific culturally or ethnic identifying. So it may cause us to question whether based on the person's name, surname, or first name, whether they have the capabilities to work within your organization, whether they're good at what they do, whether they are as, you know, smart or capable as a person, you know, with more of a traditional American pie type sounding name. And so those implicit biases carry with us, even, you know, when we're not conscious of them, and even when we think that the decisions we're making really don't have an impact, but they really do. So another example, we see in the orchestra world that many, at one point, it was the statistics shown that the majority of people who auditioned for orchestras and were ultimately picked were men. And so that most of the symphonies and orchestras, you know, the well-regarded symphonies and orchestras throughout the world and throughout our country here in the U.S. Primarily had male players and musicians. So does that mean male players or musicians are more talented than female or other their players or musicians? No, it does not. But there were implicit biases that carried on for generations to where the male musicians would be selected more often than the female or the other or their musicians. So now most well-regarded orchestras and symphonies around the country have gone to blind auditions in order to begin the process of eliminating that gender bias. So the point is we all have biases. We're all guilty of the big B. Some of our biases are conscious based on how we've been wired, and some are unconscious also based on how we've been wired. All of how we identify those and how we begin to tackle some of our own biases, specifically in the mediation context. Impact of biases in the mediation process. I've already touched on this, but our biases specifically in mediation can impede resolution. You know, if there's a lack of respect or perceived lack of respect or distrust in the process, it may hamper the party's ability to and their attorneys to hear the mediator, to believe that the mediator is really delivering truthful and honest and transparent information. It may impact settlement value. I'm going to talk about this in just a few minutes, but we may think that the other person on the other side doesn't deserve a high value settlement because of their ethnic background or their gender background or their socioeconomic status. It may impact a perceived fairness of the settlement. You know, did this mediator, you know, I as an African-American woman, if I'm in a mediation where the plaintiff perhaps is another African-American, you know, is my being African-American, am I, you know, is the perception that I'm really, you know, pushing and advocating for, although I'm neutral officially, right, the other person in the other room looks like me. So if there's a perception that even when you represent an other category that you can't be fair or neutral, or that you may have a bias against someone in another other category, then that can impact the perceived fairness of a settlement. And then again, it leads to frustration of the parties and distrust of the process and of a neutral. And I tell you, as someone who does this day in and out and who really cares about not just the settlement value or outcome of mediations, but I really care about how people leave, how they feel about the process, and their feeling that they got a fair shake, that they were heard, that they were listened to, and that they were respected, and that whatever protected category that they may fall in, that was not held against them, but that their that protected category actually brought value to the mediation, and that even the mediator, based on her, his, or their other background and experiences, that too will bring insights to the mediation that are valuable and appreciated as a part of the process. So how do we identify our biases? I've already touched on this, but the big thing is to realize that we all have biases because of how our brains work, right? And the influences that make us who we are. So we all have them. And the first step to, you know, resolving a problem or solving a problem is being aware and owning it and acknowledging it in a way where you start to personalize it and say, you know what? And you may not voice it to anyone else, right? But you start to say to yourself, you know, I recognize that I have leanings this way. And sometimes those leanings and those perspectives aren't good, and they don't make me feel good about who I am or how I see the world or how I engage with others that may be in an othered category that I may have some bias toward. So when we start to be self-aware, then and make the decision to own it and to begin to work on it, that is the very first step and probably the most important step to identifying our biases. And then, of course, once we identify them, we want to participate in opportunities to learn more about those biases and how to manage them, whether it be through training classes or exercises. I've also seen something start to arise in our culture where, you know, people across ethnic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, are hosting things like small dinners and other opportunities, hikes, to start to get to know each other in a way that's beyond just what we see and start to build relationships across whatever divides that there may be. And that is so powerful because in those instances, it allows you to be transparent and honest, but in a way to where it's well received on the other side. The other side has a chance to share, you know, kind of their perspective on how you may be thinking and in the reverse as well. And that dialogue starts to break down barriers, starts to break down divides, and starts to help us see each other really as fellow humans and not as others that are so different from me that I could never have a real conversation or real dialogue with them. So finding ways, whether it be in your company or law firms or organizations, annual training classes, but I invite you to our the Bar Association classes, even this one. After this 1 hour, I invite you to and encourage you to go and look for opportunities, other opportunities to really start to hone in on your own biases and how to more effectively manage those. And as we start to minimize, look for books, look for resources where you can start to educate yourself and own your own learning in this regard. And then, you know, once we are able to look inwardly and to think about where we personally may have some pitfalls in terms of how we see others and how we see the world, it better equips us to start to learn how to recognize it in our mediations and how to recognize it when the attorneys involved in representing their clients in mediation, where their perspectives may be based on some biases, not for the purposes of pointing fingers, but kind of tuning into it. And as the mediator, using that to see if you can help navigate, not become upset, not confrontational, not make them feel bad and, you know, call them on the carpet, so to speak. But you can use that insight and information and what you're seeing in the process to help ask questions, to help start to present ideas and options that start to minimize the impact of what some of those biases may be, whether it be from the attorneys or the litigants that they represent or that you all represent. And then identifying our biases also helps us to understand what biases individuals, litigants, attorneys may have against us as neutrals and how that is impacting the process. And I definitely want to talk about that more. What are some common biases that we see in mediation? We see cultural biases, we see gender biases, linguistic biases, and so many others. The list can go on and on. But with respect to culture, this means that we may have biases against individuals from a certain background or culture or ethnic experience. So for example, if someone at a mediation, whether it be a party or the other, you know, opposing counsel, you know, the opposing counsel, if they show up, if they're African-American and they show up, they're female or even male and they show up in with a what might be considered a natural hairstyle or afro or braids or locks, something that falls within the Crown Act, which is now has been passed here in California, prohibiting discrimination and decisions in the workplace, you know, based on how a person wears their hair, specifically their natural hair. But if we see someone that comes with something other than kind of a more traditional, what might be seen as a European styled hair that's, you know, relaxed or straightened or, you know, curled in a certain way, are we going to think differently of them? And again, you know, that could be a form of conscious bias. Like, oh, anyone that wears natural hair, I don't think they're good at what they do. I don't think they know what they're talking about. And I think they're, you know, less than a great advocate, right? Or it could be implicit, right? You never said to yourself out loud, I don't like people who wear natural hair, but maybe it's an implicit bias in you that if you're seeing someone because of how your brain processes things in a matter of milliseconds, if you're seeing someone with something other than a traditional hairstyle that you're used to seeing, you might think that that person is not as good as or smart as or as capable as, you know, something else that you would compare it to. So that's how bias can arise from a cultural perspective. And there's so many other examples. How can bias arise in a gender perspective? You know, there's the obvious, you know, we have the, you know, traditional male-female dynamics and, you know, the perception and most, and, you know, past instances, we've, you know, come a long way in some respects, but the perception is that women aren't as capable, women aren't as smart, women are too emotional, right? But we also now have to think about gender in the context of all the new gender identifiers and the ways in which gender has expanded. So thinking about people who are non-binary or, you know, people who might be transgender, you know, this is a good time in our country's history and world history and at this moment in time to really think about has our thinking around gender evolved beyond traditional male and female categories of individuals? And are we showing and exercising any new biases based on all of the new and expanded gender identifications? Linguistic differences is another example that I see throughout mediations. You know, do we favor those who speak the same language as us or who speak, quote unquote, the King's English versus a, quote unquote, broken English? Do we have bias against those who are not native English speakers or who have accents or really who have you know, maybe they, you know, speak English perfectly fine in, you know, within our definition of perfect English, right? Quote unquote. But maybe they have difficulty expressing themselves. Maybe they come from a cultural background where, you know, people, for, you know, either side of the gender equation are not used to speaking up or used to sharing their feelings or used to getting emotional. For example, in some of my mediations, I might have the party on the other side, the plaintiff might be an individual, a male generally, who comes from a kind of more of a quote unquote machismo background. And so that person may not go to therapy or see the value in therapy. And the question becomes, or talking to someone about their feelings and their emotions. So the question becomes, and especially from the defense side, is, well, if they didn't talk to a therapist or if they have difficulty expressing the emotional impact that this has had on them, then they didn't suffer emotional distress. And the plaintiff's counsel is generally arguing in the reverse, that no, just because this person has difficulty expressing it or for whatever reasons chose not to go see a therapist or perhaps can't afford to see a therapist if they're in between jobs and no longer have insurance, that doesn't mean that they did not, you know, suffer quote unquote substantial emotional distress. And the way that they express their emotion and the impact that it's had on them may be rooted in how they were raised, you know, within their specific cultural, ethnic, or national origin experience. So we definitely see bias, and from a cultural perspective, a gender perspective, linguistic, and so many others. And next slide, let's talk about a few of the others. Some of the other ways that we see biases in mediation is this perception that, you know, some, you know, are more intelligent based on their educational background or based on their ethnic background, and just based on their overall set of experiences. And if we see someone as less smart than us or less intellectual than us, or not as, you know, high of a pedigree in terms of their educational or law firm or associational background, then that feeds into how we engage in settlement discussions. If we see someone as being from a different socioeconomic background from us, particularly if it's a quote unquote lower socioeconomic background, it feeds into our perceptions that maybe that person is not as deserving of a certain settlement. Or in the reverse, if someone comes from a quote unquote hybrid socioeconomic background, it may cause a person to think differently about their values, that they only care about money, they don't care about people, that their character is questioned, right? So all of our perceptions, no matter where they may be on the spectrum, you know, depending on a person's background, their educational background, their socioeconomic status, it feeds into, and I see it every day, into how we engage in mediation. And another, you know, we're attorneys. And so we, you know, when we first get served with a lawsuit or engage with opposing counsel or getting ready for a mediation, the first thing we do is we look up that person's background and the state bar and their website. Where did they go to school? What law firms did they work at? Are those law firms considered prestigious? You know, did they pass the bar the first time? You know, all sorts of things that, you know, again, as lawyers, we're even trying to simplify through our brains, what kind of person am I dealing with on the other side? Is that person as smart as me? Is that person as capable of me? And that plays into how we engage with that person through a mediator in the mediation process. And let me just give a few other examples of some of the things that I see every day in mediation. So I broke it down into three categories. I see biases with respect to mediators and neutrals themselves, with respect to attorneys, you know, opposing counsel, and with respect to the clients that attorneys represent. So as mediators, and again, some of these biases, you know, some are not good, right? Especially if they're based on protected categories such as, you know, ethnicity, cultural background, gender background, et cetera. But some, you know, they're biases that are somewhat neutral, right? You know, but they impact how we might approach a mediation and how we might see a neutral. So one bias I see is, you know, the mediator, are they a former judge? Are they a former attorney litigator? And, you know, some attorneys, you know, that represent their clients have very, very strong thoughts about whether to pick a mediator based on whether they're a former judge or whether a former attorney. Some think that, you know, judges, you know, have the ability to say something and everybody will listen and they just strike the gavel and the deal gets done, right? But the problem and how that's connected to potential bias is that when we look at the bench or even when we look at the attorneys who ultimately become mediators, and we look at, you know, their ethnic backgrounds and the side, you know, the demographics of judges on the bench, right? If they happen to be majority white males and the majority of litigants out there are, you know, have a bias toward selecting former judges as mediators, then that means that the mediators that they select more often than not are going to be, you know, white male judges, and God bless them. Some of my best friends are white male judges, and I have so much respect for not only them, but just the bench as a whole, right? We cannot do the work we do without amazing judges, and we have so many here in Los Angeles, in California, Beverly Hills. But does it mean that the end result in mediation means that 95% of the neutrals who are selected as mediators are primarily white male? Because just the sheer thinking around the demographics and how they work, whether it's from, you know, former law firm environments, judicial environments, or other, right? So that's how bias can even creep into something like picking a mediator. Even with picking a mediator, there's the obvious, you know, potential biases based on cultural or ethnic or gender background. You may think that, you know, an African-American woman doesn't have the chance, you know, have the capabilities or the background or the experience or the sensitivities to take on a kind of bet the bank, you know, kind of mediation, or one with that's a multi-million-dollar class action, or an instance that's a case that's involving, you know, millions of dollars. So you may only pick that mediator, you know, for your quote unquote low value cases, or you may only pick them when there's another African-American or person of color or woman or disabled person. You know, the list goes on and on. You may only pick that person that you perceive to be, you know, othered when a case involves an othered, as opposed to just picking the best mediator for that particular case, you know, based on the subject matter of the case, based on the dollar value of the case, and based on that person's background and experience before becoming a neutral. So there is definitely bias in terms of picking neutrals in mediations, and then even engaging with neutrals in mediation. You know, if the person serving as your neutral, I mean, you would think you picked them, so you must have some level of respect for them. But even this is where implicit bias comes in. Even in picking them or agreeing to that person as the neutral, if they fall into some other category that you have a bias toward, you, in the course of the mediation, may question what they're telling you. You may question whether they are grappling the facts and the law, you know, in a substantive, intellectual way, if they really get it, right? Or if they're in the other room, you know, pushing the envelope with the other side, do they have that capability? And all of that comes in some instances from some very explicit biases that we have, and other instances from implicit biases that we have. Also, as for example, did the person, when they were in practice, did they represent plaintiffs or defense? Depending on which side you're on, you may have greater respect for them if they were on the plaintiff's bar, or you know, more respect for them if they were in the defense bar. But all of those things play a part in terms of how we engage our neutrals in the mediation process and the selection of neutrals for mediations. We also see biases, and I see it because I'm the person going between both rooms in a mediation, biases that attorneys have among each other. So again, you know, they may not, you know, the person may not be the neutral, but if they're the attorney on the other side, you know, there may be a disrespect for them or a questioning of how smart they are if they represent plaintiffs, or if they, you know, represent defendants. Based on law school or what their associations are, or did they pass the bar the first time? What type of school did they go to? Did they go to a top 10 or 20 school? Did they go to another type of school? All of those things play in terms of how we see the attorneys that we're dealing with and engaging with. And it comes out in mediation. You would not believe some of the things that I hear sometimes. And again, that's where I go back and say, as the neutral, as you're seeing and hearing things in the mediation rooms, the breakout rooms, that you know are rooted in some form of bias, whether it be implicit or explicit bias, then you're using that information not to make the parties feel bad, not to make using it to try to guide the conversation and guide it in a way that's more positive, and that for purposes helping to minimize the impact that all of the biases that are playing throughout the day have on that mediation process. I also see biases with respect to the clients in mediation, particularly in my line of work, with plaintiffs, for example. A lot of times the plaintiffs, you know, because employment law, you know, big part of employment law is based on discrimination, principles of discrimination, and the underlying issues are, you know, whether the person is a part of a protected category and if there were any employment decisions based on that person's protected category, right? So see individuals of color, individuals, you know, from different backgrounds, individuals with different physical and mental capabilities that might result in a claim for disability discrimination. I see clients across, you know, the full gamut of what we consider protected categories. And we know here in California, compared to federal law and some other states, we have, I think now we're probably up to about 20 or so protected categories. So you can imagine in my mediations, I'm seeing the full gamut of people and individuals who might be considered other. Really, you know, might have some thoughts about a person is telling the truth based on their perceptions of or other background. There might be some questions about, you know, if that person's of a lower socioeconomic background, you know, if they deserve, quote unquote, a high value settlement. Perhaps they were a minimum wage worker because of the industry that they work in, or their background or their educational background or experiences. And so there might be a perception that that person is not deserving of a high valued settlement. So one of the things I hear sometimes is, you know, we're offering them, you know, 1 year salary, and perhaps that salary just based on their minimum wage is $20,000 or something, right? And, you know, that's more than they would make, you know, at any time, right? And I'm seeing this a lot. Plaintiff's attorneys are saying, well, we're going to waive economic damages because the real impact here is the emotional impact that this case had on my client. And so we're focused, and, you know, when we talk about emotional impact and victim impact, you know, from the plaintiff's attorney's perspective, they're saying you can't place a price tag on that. You know, you can't just devalue or minimize the person's experience and the impact it had on them because they were a low wage or a minimum wage employee, or they came from a quote unquote low income socioeconomic background. So that type of bias plays out, and it plays in the reverse too. On the defense side, the defense attorney may be large employer, a big box employer, employer that's national or international. And so the perception on the other side is they have the money, they can pay it, and to people. And you have to be careful even in those instances that, you know, defendants, even though they may be big, they may have the money, they may have all the resources in the world. In those instances, they're saying, you know, we're going to pay based on what we think the merits of the case are, and not just because we are a big box employer, so to speak. So those are some of the ways that biases come into play in mediation, both with respect to the neutrals themselves, the attorneys opposing each other, as well as with respect to the clients that you all represent and that I used to represent. So what are some strategies that we can use to start to recognize and eliminate bias in mediation? I've already touched on them, but I'll just reemphasize it here. It really begins, and like I said, if you don't get anything else out of today's presentation, it first comes with acknowledgement and awareness. We've got to acknowledge and be comfortable with the fact that we all have biases. It's a part of our DNA. It's who we are as humans. Some of our biases are not so bad or kind of innocent, but some have a real impact on the work we do, how we engage with others, and it definitely has an impact in our mediations, in the success and the outcomes of our mediation. So it starts with acknowledgement, awareness. And I say to you, it just doesn't end there. Like, I'm biased, you know, I have issues, so is life, right? But that you, if you really, really, really want to be a better person in this regard, then you got to take the next step, even past today, even past your firm's traditional 1 or 2 hour, you know, bias elimination training each year, and start to educate yourself, start to engage in a way with others that says, you know what, I want to do better in this regard. I really want to get to know other people past what my brain immediately sees. I really want to start to deal away with some of these issues I have. Not one is good for you as a person, But it also impacts the way in which you represent your clients. It impacts getting the best outcomes for your clients. And then if you're a neutral, it does certainly helps you to be a better neutral so that you're creating a process like Maya Angelou said, where everyone walks away, you know, feeling heard and respected. People remember how we made them feel, not what we said, not even the settlement that we got them, right? Or helped them to get, but they remember how we made them feel. So education, acknowledgement, awareness, then education. And then in acknowledging, in educating, we start to do away with some of our biases through avoiding assumptions and thinking twice when we see people that we traditionally may have put into other categories in the past. And we start to be, you know, build relationships across the aisle that are based on, you know, true, you know, looking at the individual as an individual and not looking at them as one group of people that are individuals that we may have stereotyped in the past. We should also learn to empathize more. And that means placing ourselves in others' shoes. And so one of the things I do pre-mediation calls in my mediations. And one of the things that, one of the questions that I would ask, and is, you know, specifically designed to get to this, you know, empathy component of eliminating bias in how we think is, you know, have you thought about the other side and how they're going to argue the case? Have you thought about how the plaintiff might perceive what happened to them or how the plaintiff believes it may have impacted them? And I'll ask the plaintiff's counsel the same question in the reverse as it relates to the defendant and the employer, because the employer deserves to be heard as well, right? It's not just a one-way street. It's a two-way street and a two-way dialogue. So developing empathy, as litigators, as a former litigator, we come in, you know, guns blazing, constantly, you know, wanting to advocate and to fight and go full force, right? And just arguing, even throughout the mediation process, never taking off that hard litigation hat. And it's important to take a step back from that. It doesn't mean you're not zealously representing your client. Doesn't mean you've kind of let up on, you know, that representation or that you're weak in some regard. But taking a step back and encouraging your client to do the same, to just think about, even just for a moment, how the other side may be thinking and what the impact of this on the other side, the emotional impact, the business impact, that level of empathy allows us to start to, you know, put a human face on more of these situations and not just see it as the next case that we're litigating or the next case that we are mediating as neutrals. And then listening actively, you know, that goes without saying, you know, whether it be in mediation or just other environments, personal environments, family environments, you know, at work with other colleagues, you know, listening not to be heard or to immediately speak, but listening to hear and to hear what the other side is saying. When we stop and we really, really listen, it has a way of helping us to see behind, you know, whatever our traditional biases or perceptions of the other person on the other side, and really seeing them for who they are. And that is a great step toward eliminating any bias that we may have with respect to or against the person or persons on the other side. And then as mediators, you know, one of the things we want to do is encourage open dialogue. Granted, in California, most of our mediations are caucus style. The other side, you know, the two or more sides are not engaging with one another, but it's up to that mediator as she, he, or they are in the room with either side to kind of express things and to share things from the perspective of the other side, not to distance the room that you're in, but to help that room to just see that there is another perspective here. There's another set of conversations to hear, making that feel that when you're in a room with the other side, that you're doing the same thing on their behalf. Okay. Other strategies, periodic self-assessment. You know, this is a lifelong learning thing. We never get rid of our biases. You know, maybe if we're lucky, some of the biases we have, they start to minimize. Sometimes, you know, we get better at managing them. But, you know, our entire lives, we are dealing with the individual biases that we have and the impact that those biases have on our work. So as you're becoming more self-aware, you also have to be willing you know, like we do in the work environment, annual reviews, annual assessments. We have to be willing to have that, you know, periodic self-assessment with ourselves, that dialogue with ourselves. You know, am I getting better, or am I allowing my lifelong list of potential biases to still shape how I see the world and how I engage with the world? We have to be flexible. We have to realize that, you know, we all come to the against the opposing counsel that we are engaging with. We all have, you know, issues, and we're all dealing with the impact of life and COVID and the pandemic and so forth. So being flexible and understanding and seeing the world from a different perspective, and then seeking feedback. You know, perhaps you have a trusted, you know, friend or colleague that you can really be open and honest with, especially if that person is one of the other categories that perhaps you have some challenges in, and asking them, you know, what can I do better? What are your thoughts about, I said this, what are your thoughts about that? And, you know, seeking that feedback and accepting it, you know, for what it is, and then internalizing it in a way that doesn't make you feel worse about yourself, but makes you want to work on that and to determine ways in which you can engage better and kind of be a better listener, a person that has more empathy, and a person that sees humanity in the work that we do. How do we work around the biases of others? So how do we do one thing to recognize our own biases, but when we see biases in others, what are some techniques for working around that? Again, I think this is probably most important in the mediation context. And if you are actually a mediator or a neutral helping to facilitate a mediated process. So if you think there be through counsel, are there clients or individuals participating in the mediation process? The first thing, again, you don't want to confront, upset the apple cart, make everybody feel bad. It's like, you're racist. I'm ending this mediation, right? That does not serve anyone, right? So we want to take it in as mediators and neutrals and, you know, want to take note of it and then start to think about how we can redirect the focus, you know, based on the hardcore facts, the legal issues, and the theories to get the proceedings back on track. And we may want to think about questions. You know, if someone's like, you know, clearly they may have a bias toward, you know, women or disabled people or what have you, you know, maybe you can come up with a set of questions of, you know, well, what makes you, you know, I hear you. And, you know, I want to understand as your mediator, so I can better, you know, present your case and your perspective in the other room. I want to understand your thinking behind that. You know, why do you think that? Or how do you think the other side would think about that? Or how do you think the plaintiff would think about that? Or the defendant, right? So you come up with a, you know, set of non-confrontational, but guiding and critical questions to help guide the process in a more positive direction, but also allows you to kind of have that person maybe think about, even if it's in an indirect way, what they just said or a perspective that they may have that is rooted in bias that's ultimately impacting the process. Secondly, it's so important to build rapport and trust with the parties. That starts before the mediation. Again, I think the pre-mediation calls are so important because that's where you start to build trust and rapport with the attorneys, especially if you haven't worked with them before. And you want them to out the gate to see you as neutral, as someone who's respectful, and someone who's really going to work hard to hear all sides of the story, the legal issues and theories, and use that information to try to guide a positive process that ultimately leads to a positive outcome. But again, a process where everyone walks away, whether a case settles or doesn't settle, feeling that the process itself was respectful, it was a good process, and they felt like the mediator heard them and was fair and transparent. And, you know, equally leaned in, you know, all the parties and all the counsel involved. And then finally, under all circumstances, as the neutral, as the mediator, you never want to compromise your impartiality or your neutrality, even if you're feeling personally attacked by any party based on some bias that you think they may have of you. You never want to wear that on your shoulders. You never want to let that come into the process. Because once your neutrality, your impartiality is compromised, then it probably impacts your ability to continue to try to help guide the parties to resolution, or at least to a process that they all walk away feeling it was a respectful process, it was a trusted process. Now, does that mean you as the neutral just sit and receive personal attacks? No, it doesn't, right? No one, even as neutrals, even as, you know, individuals who are supposed to be impartial, no, it doesn't mean we should just sit and accept personal attacks, particularly those that are rooted in bias. But maybe it means, you know, if it's the attorney or even their client, maybe we pull them into a separate room or have a sidebar dialogue with them to say, you know, what you just said or what your client just said, you know, really did not, you know, make me feel comfortable or respected. And I would just ask that, you know, we dial down those kind of personal attacks or those kind of personal perceptions so that we can focus on getting to the issues at heart. Or maybe you don't even have that sidebar and you go back to what I suggested in box one here is you kind of breathe, you take it in for, you know, for what it's worth, you manage your own emotions in that process, and then you look for ways to engage in a positive, more forward-thinking way and to ask questions that maybe causes that person to think about the error of their own ways and to think about what they said. And I've seen so many times where individuals, whether it be attorneys or their clients, will apologize when they realize that they have offended the neutral or says something that if heard in the other room could be offensive and perceived as biased behavior. But it's so important that the neutral, even when others around you as a neutral are losing their cool, becoming frustrated, perhaps saying things that are off color or inappropriate, it's important to manage that, not just to take it, of course. You know, I'm not suggesting that at all, but to take a step back, to breathe, and to figure out how to best manage that so you maintain your impartiality, you maintain your neutrality, and you're able, if it's appropriate, to keep the proceedings moving in a positive direction. So that's my presentation today. And again, we can go to the last slide. I'd like to just thank you all so much for participating in this inaugural mediation certification training for the Beverly Hills Bar Association. I'd like to thank you, Beverly Hills Bar Association, for inviting me to be a part of this inaugural class of litigants and potential future neutrals. And I just, you know, want to encourage you all, whether you are a neutral, thinking about becoming a neutral or a litigant, and just taking this course so you start to understand how mediation works and how neutrals think and some of the theories behind mediation, to take these skills and tools with you and really to be an ambassador, you know, in our profession as lawyers, as mediators, as neutrals, of, you know, really being an ambassador and a committee of one to start to encourage folks to, and ourselves, looking inwardly first, to, you know, really dial down on the biases that we see in our profession. It impacts the outcomes of our mediations. It impacts the outcomes of our cases. And it really, you know, makes for a less fulfilling life as an attorney, as a mediator, as a neutral. And so even just, you know, taking these concepts in just for ourselves personally, you know, makes a difference in terms of our enjoyment and our fulfillment in this profession. So thank you again. I hope this has been helpful. And I welcome you to reach out to me if you'd like to continue this discussion or if I can be helpful to you in any way or any of your cases. Have a great day, folks. Wherever you are, what time you're looking at this, have a great day and a successful career as a mediator, a neutral, or just continuing being the great advocate that you are.
You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information.